2013 has been a busy year for IPR's reporters and correspondents. This hour, some of the most meaningful and challenging stories our news team has covered. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We asked members of our news team to pick a story from 2013 they would like to share again as we close out this year. So today, we remember the abduction of two teenage girls, visit a farm for refugees in West Des Moines, hear about a traveling exhibit for Iowa's fallen veterans, and the closing of a popular family-owned restaurant in central Iowa. IPR Reporters Picks from 2013, after this news. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, as we near the end of 2013, we're visiting with Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents and asking them about their favorite stories, the favorites they had that they reported on in 2013. Joining me now, Iowa Public Radio's Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
You have a favorite story of the year that has to do with a hot-button issue, an issue nationally and in Iowa that we've talked about numerous times here on the talk shows, immigration. And I really love the fact that you humanize this. Tell us about the people you met to talk about this issue.
This was shortly after President Obama sort of eased up the immigration laws for young people that are referred to as dreamers. These are people who were brought to this country. Their parents are undocumented. They were brought as children, but they have lived here just like any other American kid. The ACLU helped me find these two young women who are students at the University of Northern Iowa. I was not able to use their name. I was also not even able to identify what town they were in, because these two young women are really activists for the immigrant community there, and they thought that there was a danger to employment for their parents and others if they identified who they were. But at any rate, I got to know them very well, interviewed them in their home, and it was a very satisfying experience for me.
You refer to them in the piece as Maria and Lupita. I'm not sure if those are their real names, but that's the names you use in the piece.
Yes, and those weren't their real names. Okay. My son is fluent in Spanish and spent quite a lot of time in Mexico, so I texted him one day. I said, I need two. What would be the best names? And he said, "Well, those would be Maria and Lupita, from Our Lady of Guadalupe, of course."
For me, Joyce Russell, you know, the best sort of journalism that we produce is the type of journalism that deals with a national or state issue, and then humanizes that, as you did, and really puts it to the test of walk in my shoes. I felt like I walked in Maria and Lupita's shoes, as the way you described it, and we'll listen to that piece in just a moment. But you said you were in their house. What impression did you get of these young women?
Well, just that they're very sharp and very smart, and are working their way through college without any financial aid, because what the president did opened up some things for them. They were able to get driver's licenses and work permits and all of that, but they still can't get any federal assistance for college. So they work two or three jobs. One of them said, I asked them, how are you making this work? And she said, "We work like mules," is how she put it. And yet they're keeping it together. They'll work two or three jobs. They have much better jobs now because of the president's action. They work, then they have to drop out for a while, and then go back as they can afford it.
Okay. Joyce Russell, let's give a little listen to your story from this year, selected as one of your favorites. This is a story of two Iowa dreamers.
According to the Iowa Board of Regents, Maria and Lupita are not alone in attending a regent school as undocumented immigrants. But since the universities don't require a social security number or proof of citizenship for admission, the numbers are hard to come by. The University of Iowa reports enrolling 6 to 8 undocumented students each year who are not international students. At ISU, the estimate is 10. And at UNI, officials say they don't know how many are enrolled. Lupita says she and her sister just blend in.
Going to college undocumented, it's really It's really not that hard, except for the only aspect of it that's hard is the financial aspect of it. Otherwise, social, we're just like any other person since we've been here our whole life.
Under the new Obama policy, students still don't qualify for financial aid. And already there's been some bad luck since the president's order came down. After initially issuing them driver's licenses, the Iowa Department of Transportation says state law doesn't allow that. Maria says they're now awaiting word of bad news.
Yeah, right now, every day I've been checking the mail to see if we might, you know, have gotten some kind of notice of our licenses being revoked. But I'm one of those people that I want to achieve the goals that I have for myself. And if that means driving illegally, then so be it.
That scofflaw attitude offends some opponents of illegal immigration. But critics of the DOT decision say Maria's determination proves the young immigrants will drive to get to work and school, so it's a matter of public safety to license them. Maria will take a semester off to earn more money before resuming her pursuit of a sociology degree. When the spring semester starts next week, Lupita will be back at UNI majoring in history. Both students dream of graduate school, but unless their immigration status changes, that may be out of reach. Maria makes the case that that's unfair.
I do want to make that very clear. We were brought here illegally, but not with our consent, so you'd say. 3 years old for me, my sister was 1 year old. I wasn't able to say, hey, Mom, I don't want to live as an illegal person in the United States for the rest of my life. And I mean, I don't ever want to, you know, hold it against my mom for bringing us here. She, at the time, she knew that the life she was going to provide for us in Mexico was not going to be a good one.
Maria says she still considers herself to be illegal, even under the new program. The sisters hold out hope, however, that Congress will eventually pass legislation clearing the way for citizenship for the undocumented brought here as children. And they say President Obama's reelection bodes well for immigration reform, but only their boyfriends could vote for the president. The boyfriend's parents were also once undocumented immigrants, but Lupita says the guys were born in the USA.
So our boyfriends, they would have never voted probably if my sister and I hadn't been so adamant about voting. We got them to vote.
One possible avenue for citizenship looms in the future. Like the boyfriends, the sister's younger brother was born in the U.S. He'll turn 21 in 4 years. Then he can apply to make the whole family legal.
That was Joyce Russell's piece from earlier this year, and meeting two individuals here in Iowa, Maria and Lupita. That's the names they're going by in this piece. Joyce Russell, I can really hear the excitement in their voices, the passion they have for the American dream, especially the part where they had boyfriends who were American citizens who could vote, who needed their prompting to get out there and vote. Isn't that ironic?
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of this, and just another illustration of how thoroughly Americanized they are, even though, you know, they were born in Mexico and grew up here, very much two Iowa girls.
Joyce Russell, thanks for sharing that. One of your favorite stories from 2013. Joyce Russell, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're checking in with IPR reporters and correspondents, asking them to point to a feature in 2013 they tackled that they found special in some way. Joining us now, IPR correspondent Rob Dillard. Hi, Rob.
Hello, Ben.
Now, IPR listeners have been missing your amazing Being in Iowa series lately because you've stepped in to act as our news director, but we did ask you to point to a feature that you did earlier this year, because this Being in Iowa series has been so popular and so meaningful to look at these minority groups in Iowa. And this is a group that you looked at in February of caregivers. And the feature that you're focusing on here is?
With hospice workers. This aspect of the Being a Caregiver in Iowa series received so much response from listeners. I have never had this kind of feedback on anything I've done in my radio career, and it's been a long career. But this story about hospice workers really touched me in a big way. Many of my friends have gone through the hospice end-of-life care, and it was really important that I meet the professionals and the volunteers at the Kavanaugh House here in Des Moines.
And that's on the edge of some woods there in Des Moines. Sounds like an idyllic place the way you describe it in this feature. And we'll hear a portion of this feature coming up. But you said you were surprised by the amount of feedback you got. What do you remember what sort of feedback you had? Just appreciation.
Everyone was touched by the voices I introduced in this series. I talked with professional caregivers, a woman who'd spent 30 years in a fairly low pain, low benefit, low respect kind of industry. And she stayed with it. It's a rapid turnaround in the business of professional caregiving, but she stayed with it for 30 years. I mm-hmm. met a family with an autistic son. I met a young woman who was in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and I met her husband as well. I traveled with a home care nurse as she made her rounds in Des Moines. And each of these people don't normally have a chance to tell their stories, and I simply turned on a microphone and let them talk.
And you know, during the holidays, it's especially important for us to replay part of this and talk about it because, as you know well know, Rob, these people, the work they do, they have to work during holidays. The need is always there. And also, it really ties into this time of year too, Rob, because we take the holidays to kind of settle back and be a little calmer and think about holidays that we're missing with relatives, friends that used to be in our midst. So end of life, what a time to think back on this.
Yes, I come from a family of caregivers. I know well the pressures that go with the job and the being on call constantly. My father was an ambulance operator. My mm-hmm. brother was an emergency nurse. These people have high-stress jobs and often get called away from the Christmas dinner table.
The one quote I like from your feature, sad work but never depressing. Explain yeah. that.
Well, this came from a volunteer at the hospice house. And I think she was talking about how meaningful the work is for her. She had she was deeply involved and profoundly touched by the lives of the people that she was working with. And I think that's what she meant. It was often sad, but it was uplifting at the same time.
Well, Rob Dillard, let's listen to a bit of your feature from the Being a Caregiver in Iowa series. This is a look at a hospice home.
Hospice comes from the Latin word for guest house. It was originally used to describe a place of shelter for weary and sick travelers returning from religious pilgrimages. It was first applied to this compassionate approach to caregiving for the dying in the 1960s.
My name is Terry Corio. I am a nurse at the Kavanaugh House.
Nurse Corio provides the most direct care for residents at Kavanaugh House, managing pain, monitoring symptoms, giving medications. She's been there for 10 years. Before that, she was a surgery and pediatric nurse, but she says she felt called to hospice nursing.
End of life is a very special time, just like being born is a very special time, and it just deserves special attention.
Corio considers herself part of a larger team of caregivers at Kavanaugh House. It includes doctors, nurses, social workers, and clergy. And then there are the volunteers.
I do some maintenance work, some home repair stuff if they need me to. I drive patients back and forth to doctor's appointments or for visits.
That's retired FBI agent Jim Donlan of Clive. He's donated time to Kavanaugh House for the past dozen years. Volunteers have been part of the hospice philosophy since the concept developed. They typically perform the grunt work around the place, but Donlan says they are often the last people a dying resident sees.
I do what they call 11th hour, which is when people are very near death and a family member would like someone to be with the family and the patient at that critical time, then I'll go and sit with the patient.
He listens to the family tell stories about their fading loved ones. He holds a hand or gives a hug when needed. This is the critical and therapeutic work behind the theory of hospice care. It's making sure people in the waning days of their lives are surrounded by comfort and love. Retired school teacher Vicki Goldsmith is another of the volunteers.
I would say 90 to 95% of my time is spent in the laundry room.
But she, too, is called upon to make the more personal bedside connections, reading to residents, painting their nails, simply talking. Goldsmith finds the work sad at times, but never depressing. She says there's always hope and humor.
I took a woman out in a wheelchair one day, and I said to her, it's a nice day, and she said, they all are.
Goldsmith says this is the sort of life lesson she wanted to learn when she signed up to volunteer at Kavanaugh House. In Des Moines, I'm Rob Dillard, Iowa Public Radio News.
Glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. At year's end, we're revisiting some stories from this year. In fact, we've asked Iowa Public Radio reporters and correspondents to tell us what were their favorite stories that they reported on in this past year, 2013. Amy Mayer is my next guest, Harvest Public Media's reporter at Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Ben.
Now, yours is a delightful piece that you picked out, and we're going to hear it in just a moment, but this, it makes it sound like we're not in Iowa anymore. That's why I love it. Refugees from Burundi, Rwanda in Africa, also from Nepal, farming in Iowa. Tell us about this story.
I love this story because it brings together so many different pieces of life in Iowa. This is a story about a social service agency in Des Moines that has been involved in resettling refugees. It's about a large church in a Des Moines suburb that was growing. It's about Secretary Northey, and it's about people who have known land, have known farming in several different places where they've lived and have now been settled in Des Moines, in this capital city of a very agricultural state, and they finally had an opportunity to actually go back to growing their own food.
Mm-hmm. And this story is so delightful because it displays two faces of Iowa that I am really proud of. A humane face, helping those who have fled from their war-torn homelands, but also a celebration of diversity in the middle of Iowa. Amy Mayer, let's listen to your piece.
Grab a box. Even the barn here is a refugee, an historic structure relocated from a high school.
Chuba? Yeah? Do you want to go next?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Donna Wilterdink splits apart tomato starts and hands them to Chuba Rajavu, who now lives here, some 8,000 miles from his native Burundi. He'll also transplant peppers and cabbage and tuck seeds into the fertile soil of his new homeland. Wilterdink is the farm assistant with Lutheran Services of Iowa, the nonprofit that has been helping refugees find land to cultivate.
There you go. Thank you. You're welcome.
It's an effort the Iowa Department of Agriculture wanted to encourage. Secretary Bill Northey realized he might be able to help. He attends Valley Church in West Des Moines, which owns 35 acres of land it was in the process of developing.
Two things hit me at the same time, thinking this is a space that's just perfect for them to be able to let refugees be able to farm.
The church is just finishing a new community center, and beyond the ball fields are 24 50-by-50-foot plots with the weathered barn on the opposite side. Till now, the refugees grew food for their families in community gardens. Now they can farm. Wilterdink held a crop planting workshop in the spring.
We discussed what they could sell at market, what things would sell well at market, and what people would be interested in purchasing.
The refugees come from Burundi, Rwanda, Bhutan, Nepal, and Burma, now known as Myanmar. Wilterdink says some have saved seeds from their own countries.
The greens that they have seed from their own countries will do fine in Iowa, especially in the spring and the fall when the cooler temperatures come in.
Each grower has paid $100 toward the costs, but most of the expenses are paid by grants for now. Chantal Gatti-Matare grew various plants back in Africa, including cabbage, peppers, eggplant, and onions that she's planting here. Her daughter, Charlotte, translates for her.
She's hoping to get some money from this whole thing so she can help her family.
Gatti-Matare works the soil with a hoe. Next to her plot is one worked by a woman from Rwanda who is across from a Nepali family. Mukiza Gahitano plans to grow many of the same things he grew in Burundi.
I will plant some beans and some corn, but a lot of vegetables. Some I will sell and another part I will use in our, my farm.
As he and his wife work the land, their two young sons and a friend join the singing. All of these growers must participate in a monthly market at the church to learn sales and other skills. Other training farms in Lincoln, Nebraska and Kansas City have similarly leveraged nonprofit resources to get experienced farmers started in this country. Wiltertank will work with the farmers during the season and throughout the year so they continue to learn business skills. Secretary Northey says refugees may never change the face of industrial agriculture in Iowa, but they can certainly contribute to the local economy.
I would think we may see some businesses grow out of this.
He says just being involved in agriculture will help introduce these refugees to other farmers and opportunities. And training farms can work. Community Crops in Lincoln, Nebraska already has celebrated the launch of multiple businesses from alumni.
Amy Mayer with one of her favorite pieces from 2013. That is a delightful piece, Amy Mayer. I especially love the singing in the fields. How old were these children singing?
Thanks, Ben. The boys were, I think, around 8 to 12 years old, and then they were singing with their parents, who, you know, obviously were older. And there was a little bit of other people in the fields joining in, but it was mostly these two core families.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to hear that they could bring seeds from their homelands.
Yeah, I didn't probe that too deeply because I don't know how much U.S. immigration would appreciate that fact.
Exactly my thought when I heard it. Yeah.
They're certainly not bringing them in at a large scale, mm-hmm. and they're not selling them or producing something on an industrial scale. I guess perhaps a question would, or an assumption would be that these are not, you know, trademarked or patented seeds as we would see perhaps being attempted to be exported from the U.S. But mm-hmm. that did strike me also, that this idea that, I mean, it gets at the core of these people's lives on the land, that when they're fleeing, one of the things that would be precious for them to bring with them would be seeds. And I think that's true going back all the way to when the first Europeans sailed for the Americas, you know? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And for me personally, listening to this piece, Amy Mayer, having myself lived abroad for over a decade and having missed my native homeland, which is Iowa, I can appreciate why when you can't be in your homeland. I was, to be clear, not a refugee. Going to Europe to live, how when you're not at home and you can't be at home in a moment you want to be over days and weeks and months, it's so important to find a connection. And here the connection, the soil, the native plants, working the land.
And then I think the beautiful thing is that people are feeling that way who have come from such different and disparate locations.
Yes.
But then they all come together here in Des Moines. So not only do they have, you know, obviously increasing community with the Iowans around them who've lived in Iowa a long time, but they also are meeting each other. So there's mm-hmm. that.
I was interested to find out, perhaps before we say goodbye, are these refugees staying in Iowa? Are they temporary?
For the most part, the ones who I spoke with expect to be here permanently.
Okay, that's really great. The commonality, getting your hands dirty, growing things. Amy Mayer, wonderful piece. Thank you for sharing it with us again.
Thank you for having me on the show, Ben.
In just a moment, we'll talk with more members of Iowa Public Radio's news team. This hour, we're having each of them share a story they covered that really stuck with them in 2013. When we come back after a short break, remembering the abduction of two teenage girls from Dayton, Iowa, a tribute to fallen Iowa veterans, and a popular restaurant in central Iowa serves its last meal. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're looking back at the year that was through the eyes of IPR reporters and correspondents. We asked each of them to pick out a story that was somehow especially meaningful to them, then share that story again, along with their thoughts on reporting it. We start off with a story that gripped a small town in the central part of the state, the town of Dayton. It gripped us all in the state during the month of May. It's a story that ended with tragedy. Joining me now, IPR's Duri Buscarin. Hi, Duri.
Hi.
This has to do with the abduction of two young women, two girls, a 12-year-old Desiree Hughes and a 15-year-old Kathleen Shepherd. Tell us what we knew, what happened that first day.
The two girls were abducted on their way home from school, and Desiree was able to escape a short time later. That night, authorities found the body of their abductor in an apparent suicide. And at that point, Kathleen was still missing, and hundreds of volunteers were just combing fields, rivers, to try and find this young woman. And my boss pretty much told me to pack a bag. I didn't know when I was coming home. And it turned into, I think, a story that really gripped the entire state.
Let's listen back to your report from May of 2013. This is at the time when that big hunt is going on to find Kathleen Shepherd, Duri Buscarin, in May of 2013.
Fewer than 1,000 people live here in rural Dayton, but the population swelled as volunteers poured in to help search for the 15-year-old abducted as she walked home from the bus stop on Monday.
All you can think about is the pain that the families and everybody involved are dealing with right now, you know, and once you start looking, you just can't stop looking. Everybody out here, you know, has a job, has to work, and they want to keep going until they figure out what's going on or find her or something.
For days, searchers have used horses, ATVs, and boats to try and find Kathleen Shepherd, a teenager who friends say always has a smile and something nice to say. Friends and community members honored her at a vigil Wednesday night.
Just pray that wherever Kathleen is right now, that you keep her safe. Lord, hear our prayer.
In a town where everybody knows everybody, the events have been traumatizing. But nobody remembers what happened more clearly than 12-year-old Desiree Hughes, who escaped the abduction and alerted authorities.
Like, you wouldn't have expected it to happen in, like, a small town.
Hughes says she and Shepherd were close to their homes when a man pulled up in a red pickup truck and offered them a job mowing lawns.
They told us to, like, keep quiet so no one could hear us, but there weren't people for a long time away. I had to run pretty far in the woods to get to another person's house.
Hughes' stepfather, Mike Schwering, says it could have happened to anyone in this small town.
You know, they were offered a job to get in a truck. You know, how many teenagers are getting a jump to go make some money?
But when news of the abduction spread, members of this tight-knit community turned out in full force. Neighbors, strangers, and businesses donated food and supplies to rescuers and to families of the victims. Renee Williams has helped with the coordination through an online community newspaper called The Dayton Leader.
This has come from just in the last probably 15 minutes. We've gotten this all these donations. It's just totally amazing to me. Brings tears to my eyes.
For more than 500 students in the Southeast Webster Grand School District, Superintendent Lonnie Dane says they are focused on finishing the school year and desperately hoping to see Kathleen home safe.
You just don't know. I have always told our communities we will do everything in our power to protect the kids when they're here. You don't have protocol or you don't have a book to follow when these things happen to kids, so you do your best.
Duri Buscarin's report from May of 2013 about the abduction of two young Iowa women, 12-year-old Desiree Hughes, who escaped, and 15-year-old Kathleen Shepherd, who did not. And what did we find out later had happened to Kathleen?
In early June, authorities actually uncovered a body in the Des Moines River. I think that moment gave closure. It was a tragedy, but it also gave the community a chance to really come together. They've established a foundation called Kathleen's Hope, trying to bring awareness to abductions and victims of abduction, and also trying to pass legislation to have harsher sentences for sex offenders.
How did this story affect you covering it?
It was the first time I've ever covered something so tragic. And I didn't cry until I drove home from Dayton. It just hits you. It was like when you're in the moment, I mean, all you're thinking about is these families and what they're going through and the fact that, I mean, this is their home. This is their community. And for me covering this, I felt like it was my job. I had to kind of stay strong so that I could do what I had to do. I think that it taught me a lot about why we do what we do and the line between being there to bear witness to something and to do a story so that hopefully no one will have to go through this again.
Iowa Public Radio's Dury Buscarin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and this hour, at our year's end, we're visiting with IPR reporters and correspondents. We're asking them about the favorite stories they reported on in 2013. Joining me now, someone you've known for some time as a correspondent on IPR and who recently took over the reins as Morning Edition host. Hello to Clay Masters.
Hey, Ben.
Well, IPR listeners know you mostly for your political reporting from the State House, but you picked as one of your favorite features, this is a really interesting feature, a unique Iowa City project in music. We're going to hear this story, and I was happy to hear that you got in touch with one of my all-time favorite local musicians, Dave Zolo. What a gem, huh?
Yeah, that's right. David Zolo, he kind of follows this path of a lot of other musicians that are on his kind of playing level, in that they don't make a whole lot of money off of their albums anymore. A lot of the money that they make comes from performing live. And so it's interesting to see the different ways now that they're able to make music available to an audience. And, you know, even the way that we learn about music has changed so much. It's just interesting to see folks like Dave Zolo and how they are connecting with audiences to get their music to them.
Okay, Clay, let's listen back to this piece you did for NPR from August of 2013, and thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Iowa City librarian Jason Paulus pulls out his smartphone, enters his library card number, and begins downloading an album by local metal band Blizzard at Sea.
So it's extracting now. It's at about 90%.
It takes him about 5 minutes, and he says it's a great way to check out local music.
And we're finished, and then I can open that.
Paulus says you could be waiting at a bar for a concert to start and download an album by the band you're about to see, and then you could listen to it on your way home. This is the Iowa City Library Local Music Project. The idea for it came to retired librarian John Hyatt while he was sitting in a bar. He realized he was spending the library's budget on a bunch of musicians who weren't from Iowa.
Late one night, late for me anyway, I was watching Dave Zolo play. And I thought, you know, he's so good. How can we ship all our music budget out of town? Why don't we do more with this? And I may have had a few at that point, but I had the sense to email myself with the idea.
Here's what he came up with. If you have an Iowa City library card and a computer, you can download more than 100 albums by local musicians for free. You own it forever. Hyatt says a lot of the music is older and out of print, but some bands don't have a problem just giving the library a new recording.
And a couple times I suggested to people, you don't want to give us this brand new album. It might cut into your sales. And they didn't seem to care. I think a lot of times local record sales are sort of negligible.
That's true for David Zolo.
Some people looking for a big score. Me, I'm not worried about that no more. I want a two-tone Dodge and a .38 pistol. And I'll take off down the road like a runaway missile gonna fly.
Zolo makes most of his money on the road and has given most of his back catalog to the digital library.
I mean, I've got no problem with a test drive. I think it's a good way to do business. If you believe in your product, hey, take it for a spin. People are going to be taking it anyway. I think it's very short-sighted to not allow people to have it. The people that want it, that love it, will still buy it, I've found. And the people that, you know, just want to check it out, that, you know, that gives them an opportunity without putting everybody in this compromised situation where they're breaking the law and you have to play the angry, you know, intellectual property owner. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Zolo owns the licensing rights to his music. He makes $100 for every album he lets the library add to its digital collection. More well-known Iowa musicians like William Elliott Whitmore and Greg Brown are fans of the library project, but their work belongs to their record labels. The library has averaged about 10 downloads per album in its first year. Matt Kearney says he downloaded pretty much everything when the project launched.
It gotten to the point there's so much music on it now that you can't do that anymore. But a lot of times you'll hear there's bands where you see your posters around, you're just kind of curious. I was at a music festival locally here and heard a bunch of bands, and I'll probably download their albums and check them out.
There's a lot to check out, from jazz to punk, and a lot of Americana. This is Iowa, after all.
Lila, what haven't you done?
Librarians across the country have caught wind of Iowa City's project. Nashville Public Libraries are planning to use it as a foundation for something that goes a bit further. Librarian Jared Brennan says the Nashville system plans to curate a history of the city's music that goes beyond country to include hip-hop, alt-rock, and other genres, and makes it available beyond city limits.
Initially, we're going to make it for library cardholders only, but it's been decided to do it where we're kind of still curating a Nashville music culture as a permanent online streamable and downloadable archive, but also allowing that to be available for the world at large.
Back at Iowa City's only library, under buzzing fluorescent lights in a back room, librarian Jason Paulus goes through boxes of donated music from another era, each full of about 75 CDs.
This one's got a bunch of classical. We've got Neil Young. We've got jazz, Miles Davis.
Paulus says CD donations like this are frequent. He says it's wonderful not having to spend money on adding great music to the library's collection so users can still check out physical CDs the old-fashioned way. He's also now in charge of the Iowa City Library Local Music Project, and he has about $6,000 in his budget to diversify the digital collection next year. But as he looks over the boxes of CDs, he's reminded of the downside of the digital music revolution.
You won't be able to donate your iTunes copy of Miles Davis.
For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Iowa City, Iowa.
Joining me now, IPR's John Pemble. Hi, John.
Hello, Ben.
And you have a favorite story from the Iowa State Fair, which we love having you cover every year. And this was an Iowa State Fair with a different twist because something happened that was somewhat unexpected. Tell us about it.
It is. And the challenge of the State Fair are to find stories and aren't novelty aspects. And there was this new display called Remembering the Fallen, and it's a portable photo display of military members that have died in active service since 2001. So I think it was on the very first day of the fair, I arrived to the Richard Jacobson Exhibition Center, and this memorial was being displayed. And I mean, just within minutes of this display being set up, people were walking and looking at it. And everybody that approached it immediately got it. They went into this respectful observance as they looked at the faces of Iowans who had been killed recently. And most of these faces were of men and women that were, you know, 30 years old or younger.
Mm-hmm. So something you were unexpected. People can hear your entire piece by going to iowapublicradio.org, but you wanted to play a little sound from your experience there.
Yeah. A couple of days after I saw this exhibit and interviewed the person who's organizing it, I was doing a separate interview with one of the 10 Iowans of the day. And I spoke with Dean Kluse from Clarion. And I knew he had military service, and so I did ask him about remembering our fallen. He spent 20 years as a Navy fighter pilot, and 13 years ago he retired. He's now a farmer. And right as I asked him a question about remembering our fallen, things got really very real very fast. Something hit him. And we were not in the building. We were far away from it. So this is Dean Kluse as we're speaking about remembering our fallen memorial.
When somebody gives their life for their country, they should have been the Iowan of the day.
You recognize the name on the wall there?
Yes, there's a young man from our area that actually, when his funeral procession came through our town, all the kids got out of school and most of the people in the community lined the street holding flags. And I used that example at our next Memorial Day service. I was the speaker at that, and I used that example to talk about what it means and what sacrifice truly means, and to get across to the audience what Memorial Day is all about. And it is the fact that there are people over there that are today, while we're here at the fair, having a good time, there are people that are in harm's way that are potentially may give their life today for us to be able to enjoy these kind of freedoms.
You know, everybody knows somebody that's been in the military, and these memorials highlight loss for us. And while this was certainly about those who died in active duty, it brought people together to talk about other aspects of their life, the loss that they were experiencing. So one of the things that's wonderful about memorials is that while they can be very sad, people start to have this unity, this common ground, where it's about, you know, how are you doing since your father died or your friend died? And you'd be surprised what kind of a connection you will get. Shared experiences are the core of our existence, and loss is certainly something that helps us, the living, become better people with, I'm convinced.
Okay. Iowa Public Radio's John Pemble, thank you very much, talking about this very special traveling exhibit that he found at the State Fair in 2013. John, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a year-end River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and our look back at favorite IPR features wouldn't be complete without talking to IPR correspondent Dean Borg. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Ben.
Now, you chose a feature, I see, one of my favorites that wasn't too long ago, but sort of the passing of an iconic restaurant, a very popular restaurant in central Iowa. The name of the restaurant is?
The Suburban Restaurant. It's near Gilbert, just north of Ames, Iowa, right along Highway 69.
I remember you talking about this piece, too, and one of the special features of it is that people of all sorts went there, from work clothes to dressed up, right?
That's right, and the menu reflected that. It was very good down-home cooking, but it was accented by people who really cared about their customers. They got to know them, and even if you were new in the restaurant, it was somebody who struck up a conversation with you about the weather or whatever. You know, it wasn't just what you ordered today.
Okay, Dean Borg, let's listen back. November of 2013, a feature by Dean Borg and a visit to the Suburban Restaurant along U.S. Highway 69 north of Ames.
It's only late afternoon, well before the traditional dinner hour, but already the tables are full. Hopeful diners are standing, awaiting seating at the Suburban Restaurant.
Lately, since we've announced we're closing, it's just been crazy.
That's Diane Cox, one of a pair of sisters who've been part of the Suburban since their childhoods, when their parents were doing the cooking.
That means we've seated over 100, probably 150 at times.
That's saying something, because there are only 50 chairs in this homey setting, but the placemats on the table tell why. After 50 years, Suburban is closing.
Some are very, very sad, and we are too. We're sad too. But just health issues and getting older. My sister's 67 now, so, you know, she's thinking of retiring. And
that sister, Nancy Bates, who also grew up in the Suburban operated by her parents.
We did dishes. We waited on tables. Did salads. We did grocery shopping. We did everything.
And that included hospitality.
It was my mom and dad's idea that when people came in, they were family. You treated them as if they were your cousins or your aunts or your grandparents. You talk with them, you get to know them, they get to know you. I had many customers come to my wedding, come give me baby gifts when my children were born. They all showed up when our parents died. So, yeah, they were part of the family.
And the menu reflects the same family kitchen atmosphere.
I think we have tried to keep what my mom and dad started, good home cooking, probably the oven-baked steak. My dad started that, probably 60 years ago. It's round steak, and it's tenderized and grilled and baked in a gravy.
And just like home, entrees include dessert.
Oh, yes. Homemade pies and cake. My favorite would be probably coconut cream cake. That comes with a meal. Yep. When you're at home, you have a meal and you have dessert.
Among the dinner guests this evening is a petite, meticulously groomed woman sitting near the squeaky, swinging kitchen door.
My name is Anna Lamp. I live in Ames, Iowa, in the country.
Anna says her late husband was on Iowa State University's faculty, and she's retired from ISU's Hilton Coliseum staff. But it's evident she's now alone.
Well, my home is now in Ames, but I'm originally from South Wales, Great Britain, so I am a long way from home.
And these final days for the Suburban are painful.
I don't want to talk about the closing. That's too sad.
Because at 81 years old, it's a part of her life.
I know we came when mother and father were here. We knew the mothers and father. We ate here with them when they were cooking. We saw these girls when they were younger and they were waiting on tables. Mm-hmm. It's been a long time. Mm-hmm.
And like so many other suburban regulars, it's food and family.
It's the atmosphere and the food. These people make you feel like your family. And when you're a long way from home and you have no family around, this is where you come. Because you are family to them. They look out for you.
And she's assured that'll continue, even after the restaurant closes.
Well, I hope when I need something, they'll cook it for me. I've already told them that.
What did they say?
If I'm going to do a party, you better be ready to cook.
But, unfortunately, that personalized service is probably only for Anna Lamp, as after 50 years, the suburban restaurant closes its kitchen. I'm Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio News.
And that's all we have to dish out for this hour of River to River. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.